Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill, always color coordinated.
Always.
Yep. Today I'm wearing white and blue.
White and blue.
There's some red somewhere.
And I'm kind of wearing white and blue as well.
We got the memo.
We called each other this morning.
The white and blue memo.
Yeah, today on the show, a little silver and gold theme. We're going to talk to Garen Busolini. She is the co-author and photographer for a relatively new book out by Timber Press called Elegant Silvers. And as the name suggests, it's about plants that have silver foliage. Real nice book. It highlights a lot of really great plants, but it goes a little bit further in terms of talking about why plants function so well that are silver.
It's a defensive mechanism in some cases, and I've never had a lot of luck with silver plants, or I felt in my mind done them properly, so I'm looking forward to learning what I'm doing wrong. I like them, but I just kind of throw them in as an afterthought. I think sometimes I don't really think about them,
so we'll get a
Miss
new
Busolini
will give us a new perspective on using silver plants.
I need it.
And then we're also going to talk to Tom Gladney. He's with the Greater Louisville Koi and Goldfish Society?
Precisely. Right? He's the president thereof, and he's going to talk about koi, which I've got the small pond out here at Hidden Hill with a few goldfish, and a neighbor just gave us three sort of semi-koi. They're quarter koi, I guess.
They're hybrids.
Like a quarter horse, they're quarter koi.
Their parents weren't married.
really. So I'm looking forward to getting some better, larger koi and finding out all about them, because I know there's a long history and they can be very expensive and they're fun to look at.
They can live a really, really, really long time.
Yeah.
You know, we don't have some fancy little fish pond like you do, right? We just have a regular old farm pond, which we call the lake.
Right.
And you know, we've got about 8 to 12 koi that have been in the lake that have been there for over 20 years. Somebody gave a bucket full to mom and dad and they just dumped them in there.
They're huge.
And like, it's fun because you'll see them certain times of the year. And my sunglasses are prescription and they're polarized.
Oh.
So when I'm out mowing,
the
point is that the polarization, I guess, allows me to pick up the color of the koi more easily if I'm mowing in that back field and they're kind of along the edge. So it's pretty cool.
So you can see the attack of the killer koi.
Yeah. Much better than the average eye. Polarized sunglasses.
Has there ever been a bad koi? There's no anti-koi movies.
I don't think so.
The attack of the deadly koi.
Right. The attack of the 300-year-old and 300-pound koi.
Right.
But we'll find out. We'll find out from Mr. Tom Gladney, who's going to be joining us in the studio here in just a little bit to talk about koi. All right.
I can't wait.
Yep. So, Bob, what's going on in your garden?
Actually, along with the color theme today, I was kind of making a list of plants I like in the fall because of their vivid colors, besides what Mother Nature gives you in leaves. The Heliopsis. Starting to come on, the bright yellow flowers. I love that. I got the cardinal vine, that little red annual vine that's really doing well now. So I got bright red, bright yellow, purple hyacinth bean.
Of course.
Another natural, bright purple. And a lady in red hydrangea, which I've come to like a lot.
I don't know the lady in red
It's
hydrangea.
Got a red stem. Not screaming red, but a nice kind of elegant royal red. I like that a lot. So there's a lot of, seem like, fall options for bright colors if you plan a little bit ahead again.
I think so, absolutely. Well, and our favorites will be coming on here pretty soon as well, like the goldenrods, the fireworks, all that, asters, radons,
radons beauty or something?
Radons something. It's not that. Beauty, right on something.
There's an October skies, too.
Yeah, the asters. There's loads of cool things that will be coming on. And they do sometimes have a tendency to be a bit more bold.
They are, and you have to just look forward to them now this time of year because you know they're coming in September, October.
Yeah.
Another reason.
Bam.
Two more reasons to live.
Exactly. Nicely put.
How about the Wishy Estate? What's happening?
I've been working on making sure that I'm really good about processing the things that I'm growing, right? You can't eat everything when it all comes in. So I made a big old batch of basil pesto last night. You can put it in the freezer. You know what I mean? You can package it up in little containers, put it in the freezer, and use it all winter long. But it's so easy to make. It's basically just a bunch of basil, olive oil, pine nuts, garlic, a little salt and pepper, and
bad breath.
some Parmesan cheese.
And you beat it with a stick or what?
And you put it in the Cuisinart.
Oh.
And chew it up.
Not cheating?
Oh, no. You need the Cuisinart for this for sure. Yeah. No, because it's got to be like fine. And then you just boil some pasta, throw your pesto on there, and you have a meal.
You get to say pasta and pesto, too.
Oh, the pesto pasta. Exactly. Also, I've been making some really good beet salads. I really like beets.
I do, too.
And they're good for you, of course.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't make it in that traditional sort of way. I don't boil the living daylights out of them either.
Cut them in four pieces and eat them.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what I do.
Well, they're great, like kind of made into like a little relish with corn, put it on top of a salad.
Yeah.
It's really nice. A little oil and vinegar, salt and pepper. I've sauteed up some leeks and mixed those in with the salad.
Yeah.
Yeah. A little fennel.
What time do you eat?
Well, usually we eat about 9:30 at night in the summer.
I'm asleep by then.
I'll bring you some, though. But the fennel also is a nice complement to the beets as well. You know, just trying to do things a little different and using everything that I've got.
Now, were you born to cook, or is it something you developed as a teenager? Or when did you start really liking food and cooking like this?
Well, we were the kind of family that always sat down and ate dinner together.
Yeah.
And Mom always cooked a meal.
Oh.
So I think it was just something we grew up doing. And then once you get to a point where you, if you're not going to get it unless you do it yourself, you'll learn to appreciate it if you want to eat good food.
Well,
and I always kind of want to eat good food.
Yeah.
Because I like food so much, I got to...
Yeah.
So it's fun. But it is. It's relaxing for me too, Bob. After like it's so hot outside and you're working, and then you can come inside and kind of relax and transition.
Oh.
And cooking has a nice sort of mantra for me, you know.
Yeah. I like to water plants and do that.
Yeah.
There's something idiotically wonderful about watering thousands of containers of plants. And your thought
process.
Good thing
you like it because I'm sure you get to do it a lot.
But your thought processes are working and totally unrelated to H2O. But
yeah. Right, yeah, exactly. Right. Maybe it's because like chopping and other things, it's easy. You know, it's the kind of the easier thing that I can do in my life. Watering for you, it's easy. You don't really have to use your brain so much.
No.
You just have to do these motions.
Yeah, and so much for a deeply philosophical discussion
of
what's happening in the garden.
All right, well, we do have one thing on the calendar. My friends on the sunny side.
I know,
they
love you.
I do love them. And you are one of them. The Clark County Soil and Water Conservation District in southern Indiana is holding its fall 2008 tree sale. The deadline is September 15th. Fabulous trees. I mean, honestly, really, really, really good selection of trees. They're small, ideal for planting in the fall. They're fabulous prices, and it supports, of course, the Soil and Water Conservation District there. So deadline's coming up September 15th, but the pickup time for getting the trees September 29th through October 3rd. And of course, for more information, go to our website.
And you don't have to be a Hoosier to get the stuff.
You do not have to be a Hoosier. I've purchased trees from them in the past.
Much as you might want to be a Hoosier.
Proudly am a Kentucky girl, but certainly respect you all.
They'll grow south of the Mason-Dixon, too.
Yeah, that's right. All right.
Do you suppose there's any koi in the Ohio River?
I would think that all those big catfish might eat them before they got in any size.
Well, I think they're carp related.
Oh, yeah.
And I know there's carp in there.
So it would be like cannibalism.
We need an expert to find out.
We do.
We happen to have one,
okay, good.
Tom Gladney, president of the Greater Louisville Koi and Goldfish Society, has been a koi enthusiast for about 20 years and got into selling koi about 13 years ago when his Louisville employer was sold and he was looking for other opportunities. So in one sense, at least, we know he struck gold. Tom, welcome to Homegrown.
Thank you.
We're always curious about background, how people get started in their particular hobby or interest, and what got you interested in koi and or goldfish?
Well, I was interested in koi before I knew what koi were, and most people really don't know what koi were. I'd seen what I thought were giant goldfish in fancy ponds in Hawaii, and I used to travel for business, and I'd seen those and was always interested in them. I'd always raise fish myself. And I had a friend involved in it, and about the time the company I was working for was sold, and I found that there was nothing in my industry here in town. I didn't want to leave town. I decided to get into it instead of just as a hobby, as a business as well.
Mm-hmm. That's a pretty good leap of faith, though, to go from you were a chemist with a local company here to selling koi and koi supplies, I'm sure. You a little nervous about that?
Yeah, well, it was one of the deals where I'd been with the company 27 years. They sold us to the French, and the French shut our company down here in town.
Right.
And I spent a year sending out resumes and doing interviews, and most of the people, if they called me in for an interview, spent two-thirds of the time wanting to know why I wanted this job because it was below my qualification.
Oh, mm-hmm. Okay.
So it was a leap of faith no matter what you were going to be doing. Well, so why not the fish?
I had jobs out of town, but yeah. I had four kids that had been born and grown up here were all in middle school or high school, didn't want to move. And so
good.
It was just one of those things.
Let's talk about the history and the culture of koi going way back thousands of years.
Okay, koi, actually, the first recorded history of koi was between 200 and 300 B.C. in China.
Wow.
And the first recorded record of colored koi, which is what carp really are, was also, I think, in China somewhere around 300 or 400 A.D. Mm-hmm. But then...
In artistic representations, is that where we're mainly seeing the images of the fish or in writing?
There was actually, the first was actually a book published in 500 BC referring to the breeding and culture of koi, which, you know, that goes back a long way. But then our breeding and culture of carp, rather, not koi, the actual true development of the artistic part of the koi really goes back to the early 1800s in Japan, although there was a lot of culture and breeding of carp that led up to that.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell us about that relationship. How do you get from carp to koi?
Yeah, and like, can we kind of iron out what the differences are?
If any.
Yeah.
Okay, between...
And nomenclature, too, I guess.
Yeah, I guess, well, really, goldfish and koi are both carp.
Okay.
But goldfish are so far... in the distant past of carp, but they no longer look like carp, and they have different physiology. Koi are exactly carp that are colored.
Okay.
Physiologically, a koi is a carp. Okay. There is no real difference in them.
But if it's color, and when you say colored, do you mean two different colors, or you know what I mean?
Not necessarily. It's the first koi came about from they discovered colored carp, which is just a genetic anomaly,
a mutation, somehow,
and then
it's like
they started breeding that.
Okay,
so it can be a single colored, it can be a multicolored. There are names for each of the varieties.
Huh. Interesting.
Then take us on the journey from Asia to Europe and the United States. How'd they get here and when?
As travel and transportation. You know, advanced. They started moving in, but really, it was probably the real time period where koi had become very popular in the United States and very available in the United States is probably only over the last 50 or 60 years.
Right.
I don't think prior to World War II there were very many koi in the United States.
Mm-hmm. And just in the last probably 25 years, with the increase in number of people that have backyard. Garden ponds, that sort of thing. I would imagine the whole thing has really exploded.
Oh, there's been a real explosion of the ponds and the water features in people's yards. The availability of koi, both imported and domestic. There's a big business now in the United States of domestic raised koi versus the imported koi.
So, in terms of the different kind of koi that are available, because Tom, I remember years ago, some folks gave my parents a bucket, you know, like a drywall bucket full of young koi. They dumped them into our farm pond, and we delight every year. Certain times of the year, we see them. So they're like this big now, which is what about a foot and a half ish.
Right.
And I was telling Bob with my polarized sunglasses, I can usually see them on the surface much easier. So they're alive and well in our farm pond. I know other people have problems with koi in terms of spending a lot of money on a certain koi, and then having some varmint come and snatch it out of their pond. So I know there are different levels at which you can purchase fish in terms of size, in terms of price. Can you give us an indication what the difference are between the cheaper versions versus the pricier versions?
And how
we can protect them too.
There's two main classifications you break that down into. And there's a big misconception. A lot of people think, well, I can't afford koi.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really not true. There are imported show quality koi. There are other imported koi that would not be show quality, and they're domestic koi of both pond qualities, the higher quality, which you call a premium grade, or a premium select quality, which is really a show quality domestic mm-hmm. koi. Anyone getting into a pond to begin with really wants to go with a domestic koi. One, they're healthier, and they're immensely less expensive than an imported koi are. Uh-huh.
How much are you talking about?
Small, good quality koi start generally around $10.
Okay.
If you buy in a 3 to 4 inch size. Now, as they go up in size, the price goes up rather dramatically. Mm-hmm. Just from the time and the expense of raising the fish and feeding it to a larger size.
And what can a high end be theoretically?
High end on koi? On
imported? In the world.
$100,000.
Wow.
But it's like buying a Triple Crown winner.
Yeah. Mm-hmm,
The premium koi that win the All Japan Koi Show, somebody may pay $100,000 to get it to put it into their breeding program.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's the stock they're breeding, just like breeding a thoroughbred horse.
Well, what do you look for?
Yeah, what are they looking expensive? For?
Pattern, confirmation.
Color pattern. Different colors, one color, does it matter?
It matters in that there was a matter of what you're looking for, and if you're trying to show a fish, the pattern and the type of fish you're getting, it becomes very important.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about starting a koi pond in my backyard in Louisville. What's the minimum dimensions and size?
Koi pond versus a goldfish pond.
Right.
You can put in a goldfish pond that's 18 inches deep. You can use one of the preform ponds you can buy and dig a hole and put it in the ground. That is too shallow for koi. For koi, in our area, you need to be at least 30 to 36 inches deep.
Okay.
That doesn't mean the whole pond has to be that deep, but you have to have an area that deep for the koi to overwinter. That's where the warmer water is, and they don't hibernate like a bear hibernates and go to sleep, but their metabolism slows down. Mm-hmm. They're very slow swimming and don't move very much during the winter unless disturbed.
Okay.
So you need a pond that's about 3 feet deep. Deeper is better.
Mm-hmm.
It also helps with that conformation we were talking about on the body shape of a koi. Size. There's a saying among pond owners that your first pond is never big enough, or your second, or your third. people that get into koi seem to be constantly wanting to
add a little bit more,
make their pond bigger or bigger, because you get into wanting more koi, and you want the koi to be big in size. So, I mean, if you're really going to grow fish that are 2 to 3 feet long, then you need a sizable pond.
And that can take 10, 15, 20 years to get that big.
Surprisingly, with a few fish in a pond and proper water quality and food, it doesn't take that many years. Mm-hmm. You know, 3 to 5 years.
So what are their feeding requirements?
Koi, it said, will eat just about anything a human being will eat.
Mm-hmm.
However, and some people do feed them fresh vegetables and fresh fruits. They report to love watermelon and things like that. However, that tends to make a mess in your pond. Your best general thing is to feed a well-balanced koi food.
Mm-hmm. But is it an everyday sort of thing, or a little bit every day?
They don't have to be fed every day. Most of us who have them like to feed them every day. One, it helps them grow. Two, it makes them very friendly to us.
Mm-hmm.
I can walk out to my pond or walk out on the upper deck of my house that is above the pond.
And they think it's feeding time.
And all the koi swim to that end of the pond the minute they see me or hear me.
Uh-huh.
And that's, you know, they've gotten used to being fed, and they know you're not a threat to them. But you don't want to feed them catfish food or trout food, which has the wrong balance. It's got way too much corn and non-protein in it. It's not the right balance of food.
It'll just make them fat, won't make them grow big.
Right.
And you get baby koi too. Your fish reproduce in your pond?
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, in most ponds, if you've got a water garden, and when you get into pond owners, there are the purists who want to have basically a swimming pool full of koi.
Yeah.
To those of us who like to have our koi in a water garden setting where we have water lilies and plants and things around it. In the swimming pool environment, koi generally do not breed. In the water garden environment where you have plants and everything is present in the pond, they normally do breed. sometimes the ones that come from a swimming pool type environment will, you take them to a show, put them in a show tank, and something triggers them and they breed in a show tank.
It's a sex free for all.
And we have that problem almost every year at the koi show.
Funny. That's pretty funny, actually.
Because our show is at the end of October, yeah. I mean, end of May, which is the ideal time in this part of the country for a koi to be breeding.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the Greater Louisville Koi and Goldfish Society, of which you are president. And how can people join, and what can they expect if they do join?
The main objective of the club is just to help hobbyists get involved and to share information about the hobby. They can easily join by going to our website, which is www.louisvillekoiclub.com. Okay. And there's information there that where they can contact myself, the treasurer, any of the other officers. We're there to help other hobbyists with the problems that they have, or getting started, or just wanting more information on how to take care of their koi.
Sounds good.
Hey, goldfish.
I've got one last question for you. What is a good way to protect your koi from perhaps a passing great blue heron or some such thing?
The two biggest,
is it tricky?
Yeah, the two biggest predators we have are the great raccoons. Blue herring and raccoons. There are some design things you can do, making it difficult for the herrings always land away from your pond and walk up to it.
Okay.
If you make it where there's not a good path for them, where they land to walk to the pond, that discourages them.
Mm-hmm.
Making the pond with deeper edges, getting away from real shallow shelves in your pond,
mm-hmm.
that helps make it more difficult for the herrings and the raccoons to get to your fish.
Sure, sounds good.
Out in this rural area, and I had a raccoon problem about 3 years ago, and I've redesigned my
and it's working
pond
for you.
Just for that reason. Yeah,
great.
Well, Tom, thank you very much. It's been helpful and enjoyable, and went
quite
swimmingly.
I thought it went swimmingly indeed.
Tom Gladney is the owner of Enchanted Water Gardens near Crestwood, which features koi fish, and is president of the Greater Louisville Koi and Goldfish Society. For more information on him or koi, visit our homegrown page at wfpl.org.
Karen Busolini talks about elegant silver, striking plants for every garden, coming up next on Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Bet you're going fishing all of the time, baby going fishing too. Bet your life, your sweet wife, catch more fish than you. Many fish bites if you got good bait. Here's a little tip that I would like to relate. Many fish bites if you got good bait. I'm a going fishing, yes, I'm going fishing, and my baby going fishing too. I went on down to my favorite fishing hole, baby grabbed me a pole and line. Threw my pole on and caught a 9-pound catfish. Now you know I brought him home for supper time. Proving any fish bites if you got good bait. Here's a little tip that I would like to relate. Many fish bites if you got good bait. I'm a going fishing, yes, I'm going fishing.
Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm the Silver Fox, Bob Hill.
You are the Silver Fox, just barely.
I think Charlie's got that one.
Yeah. But yeah, we're going to talk a little bit about elegant silver plants with Karen Busolini, who's joining us. She's the co-author of Elegant Silvers. It's a book that looks at the genre of plants. I guess we can call them a genre of plants, Bob.
Yeah.
But she looks at them not only for their beauty, but also their ability to survive well under not so ideal circumstances. Karen also took the photographs included in the book and is joining us now from her home in Connecticut. Karen, welcome to Homegrown, and thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
Sure. Why an interest in silver plants? How did you get involved in at least having the knowledge, I guess, to write about them, but also the idea behind the book?
Oh, pure desperation. I live up here in northwestern Connecticut, and being a garden photographer, I travel just endlessly because when you photograph gardens, you have to go there.
Right.
And so it's sort of like the shoemaker's children. You can imagine what my garden looks like when the going gets tough. I'm not here. And I have a tremendous deer problem. I will sit up in bed and look out at the back slope where my garden is and see 10 deer in the morning. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't help to but notice when I came back from travels that the only thing left was silver. So things that I didn't water at all, mm-hmm. and things that had intense deer pressure, I started thinking, hey, I think I'd like a few more
of
these.
You're onto something there, huh?
Yes.
Wow. And what about the idea for the book?
Well, the idea from the book actually came from my co-author, Joanne Gardner.
Okay.
And I had always grown a lot of herbs, but she's a real herb expert and heirloom plant expert and an expert also on biblical flora and had been botanizing in Israel quite a bit and was there one spring when the Negev Desert was in bloom.
Wow.
And it was just a sea of silver plants with beautiful pink flowers. Mm-hmm. And that just, something clicked for her. And so when once we met, she, with her typical understatement, wrote me a letter and said, I've always felt that my books were under-illustrated. Would you like to join with me and do a book together?
Great.
And the idea just resonated with me because not only from my experience, but the more I thought about it, the more interesting it got. You know, I thought, oh, well, there were herbs. There's the whole idea of xeriscaping, you know, of using low water use.
Right. So, and we'll get into a lot of the practical sides of using silver plants, but it was funny earlier when Bob and I were talking, he said, you know, I'm excited about this interview because I feel like I have underutilized silver plants. I just sort of take them for granted and you stick them in here or there. And it really is sort of a fresh new look at a category of plants, if you will, that I think a lot of people do kind of take for granted.
Well, they do, and there's something very special. I mean, on you know, a practical level, there are lots of reasons, but in the garden, they're just pure magic, and it's not like any other color because silver's not really a color at all.
Yeah, right. And there's so many variations of it, right?
Oh, yeah. When we have looked at what makes plants silver and then taken them and realized there's a range that's really from the gray-greens to bright silvers to really kind of silvery blues. Mm-hmm. So it's a tremendous range of color, and of course they all look good together, that whole range from, you know, say a silvery blue grass with a gray-green herb. They all kind of speak to each other, and they make other colors work better in the garden, too.
Yeah, I was sitting here imagining your garden in a full moon.
Oh,
it makes
you
want to drive to Connecticut to be there the next time it happens, because I just, the thought of that and all that silver and iridescence.
Well, that's
on a clear
night.
That's
a big element. We often, I often work in the garden until, when you're inside in the house, you think it's dark, but when you're outside, it's surprising how much you can get done. And I've lined a lot of paths with silver plants so I don't break my neck coming in. When my husband calls out and says, honey, are you coming in soon? It's time for dinner.
Karen, you mentioned that herbs earlier, that and a lot of these plants seem to fall in the herb category, and they're useful as well as beautiful. Is there a connection there between the herbs and a lot of silver?
Yes, there is, actually. Silver is an adaptation to drought or wind or excess sun. Silver plants originated in very tough climates. And another sort of mechanism for survival is having small leaves that reduces the leaf surface so less evaporates, and having volatile oils that somehow keep humidity in the leaf, and they make them unpalatable to many critters. But
useful medicinally or culinary or otherwise. Wow.
Exactly. So there are many, many silver plants that have medicinal qualities.
It's so funny. That's what I love about this show and like being able to talk to people that know things like you. You know, like you can, you just said something that makes perfect sense in that larger scheme of things. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
These plants have the ability to survive in certain places, but because they can do that, is because they have these things, as you say, the volatile oils, and that's what makes them desirable in the kitchen or desirable in a medicinal sort of fashion.
Right.
And it's as simple as that, you know, or as complicated as that.
Well, it, you know, the more we looked into it, the more interesting it got. Mm-hmm. So we can go off in all kinds of directions, but, you know, there are lots of colors. You know, there's red foliage and there's yellow foliage, but the thing about silver is that it's silver for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
And we divide them into three, there are three main reasons why a plant is silver, and their adaptations. One, maybe the first silver plant people think of is lamb's ears, which have light-colored hairs. And if you just soak a hunk of lamb's ears in a bucket of water, or if you look at them after a long rain, you'll see it's really a green leaf underneath. Mm-hmm. But these light-colored hairs reflect the sun.
Oh.
And they're like a cocoon. They trap moisture next to the surface of the leaf.
Mm-hmm.
And as a friend in Tucson pointed out, where, boy, they really have sun, each little tiny hair makes a shadow on the leaf.
So it shades it.
So it
reflects it,
it
and shades it.
So that's one way that silvers protect themselves, is by having hair or down. We call them the downy silvers. Another mechanism is to have a waxy coating. And if you think of like clove pinks or blue spruce or eucalyptus.
Kind of glaucous.
It's glaucous. It's like the bloom on a plum, and you can lick your thumb and rub it right off and see that there's a green leaf underneath.
Right.
And then there's another group, which is the variegated silvers. And some of them, these are shade plants, and they can take more sun than most shade plants. You think of maybe the Japanese painted fern or heucheras. Pulmonarias, the lungworts, it's believed that they actually have air pockets underneath the variegation that acts like air conditioning.
Wow.
That's neat.
So some of the new silver pulmonarias are really much more adaptable to heat and to sun than the old-fashioned kind.
And, you know, Karen, it's a good lesson, too, in terms of placement of plants. You know, when you bring a plant home from the nursery, because I've even noticed that some hostas that have really thick foliage and also have somewhat of that, you know, they aren't particularly silverly looking straight away, but they have a little bit more of a glaucous sort of nature, as you said, that that kind of white stuff you can wash away if you lick your thumb and rub it on the foliage, that they will fundamentally hold up better in a drier sort of area or in a little bit more sun than I would normally put hostas.
Yes,
so it's a good lesson just in terms of placement of plants when you bring them home.
Yeah, in fact, they're kind of married to the life cycle of the forest in that in the spring when they need protection, the blue hostas are really blue, and there are some new ones that have very substantial leaves that are really good plants that they're a little too tough for the slugs to chew on.
Right.
And then you may notice that they get less blue as the season goes on. Well, the trees overhead, if you have them under broadleaf deciduous trees, once they leaf out, they're not getting as much sun. They don't need to be protected as much, so they're not going to waste their energy keeping on producing this waxy coating.
Right. We get a lot of questions about deer and problems with deer. Are there any particular silver plants that deer don't eat that you've noticed anyway?
Well, in my experience, deer eat everything on the deer do not eat list.
I had some eat some eryngium the other day.
Oh, my God.
Isn't that weird?
That's
it's
terrible.
Silver and prickly.
I'm looking at it right now. they'll try anything once, and if it's unpleasant, I mean, that's another mechanism. Those reduced leaves on eryngiums become sharp, so they reduce loss of moisture and they protect themselves. I tend to put a deer repellent on anything I plant that's new, but there are a few plants in my garden that they have never touched. And I think that these are probably plants that will do well for you, too. They're very adaptable. They've never touched any Artemisia, and Artemisia Powis Castle will take quite a bit of humidity. I think we
I think it does a little bit here.
Of Louisville weather up here, and mine are looking pretty good. The buddleias, butterfly bush, I've never had them touch that, and that doesn't even really smell or anything. Caryopteris, they've never touched, and lamb's ears, they've never touched.
All really good plants.
Yeah,
and all
great
plants,
plants
good for us, too, yeah, absolutely.
Now, we've heard a lot over the years the infamous, or famous, not infamous, all white gardens or all blue gardens, but you don't hear much about all silver gardens. Why is that?
Actually, Gertrude Jekyll in the early 20th century really championed all silver gardens.
Okay.
And she orchestrated the experience of walking through her garden, and she kind of routed people so that they would go through her hot borders first. And then when they were completely sated with color, they'd come to the, what she called her gray garden.
How clever.
And actually in the early 20th century and late 19th century, gray gardens and silver gardens were a big fad, and there was something that kind of began with Vita Sackville West, even though it's sort of funny, her garden was a white garden, mm-hmm. but she started what became known as the silver cult.
Yeah, because she incorporated a lot of silver in her white garden.
Just she did, exactly.
I mean, it was the same to her, yeah.
Yeah, so it's funny that it was called the silver cult because hers was really a white garden, and silver was very much just a backdrop for white flowers. Mm-hmm. I guess most gardeners are fairly opinionated. I hate white gardens because white flowers just look, you know, they're either great or they look awful.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, they turn brown when they're not white.
Yeah.
But I must say that silvers as a background make whites a lot easier to use because they give them a context. You know, when you think of, say, a big clump of white phlox in a garden surrounded by dark green, it just looks like a big blob. It looks like a hole. But if you put it, say, next to Arizona cypress or some kind of evergreen with that blue-silver foliage, you know, suddenly there's a conversation going on. Mm. It has a backdrop. It has a context that doesn't contrast so violently, and it starts to be more graceful in the garden. So I find that whites are really just magical, and especially at dusk. You know, you talked about
right.
dusk a while ago.
Yeah.
But I get really excited about using color with silvers, because, as I mentioned before, silver is not really a color, and it has this kind of mysterious quality that you can't quite put your finger on. So if you get, well, if silver is sort of has a no-color quality, you get other plants that are they're sort of, you know, you can't quite put your finger on what color they are, like some of the sedges that, you know, look brownish or rust-colored.
Right.
Those look really cool with silver, very sophisticated palette. Or if silver is so light, contrast something dark with it for a real punch. And one of the most simple and effective contrasts I saw was at the Chicago Botanic Garden, where they had a huge checkerboard garden that was simply boxwood and Artemisia Valerie
oh.
finish.
Oh, yeah.
And it was just a knockout.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think it's like the simplicity of it and the elegance of it. You can't deny it, that the silver quality with just something that's green like that.
Yeah, yeah, it's very special. And, mm-hmm. But then when you get vibrant colors, I really go for vibrant colors, and I love throwing, you know, orange, magenta, red, pink, everything together. And I like that vibration, and silver is what we call a peacekeeper. Somehow it has the ability to, whatever color you throw at it, it keeps
peace
between
them. Can absorb it a little
them.
Bit. Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's funny. It sort of simultaneously contrasts with everything and blends everything.
Hmm. So, Karen, I know this is always a tough question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Do you have, particularly for people that haven't been growing many silver plants before, do you have a couple of extreme favorites that you just think everybody should include in their garden?
Oh, sure, that are really easy to grow.
Yeah.
There are a few classics, and they're classics because they're adaptable.
Mm-hmm.
I can give a couple rules of thumb that will help people grow silvers.
Sure.
Which is that the hairier the leaf, the better drainage and more sun
okay.
and more air circulation they require. Drainage is really the key to most silvers. But that said, the lamb's ears, Artemisia Powys Castle seems to be very adaptable.
Mm-hmm.
Lavenders, if you have a lot of sun and good drainage.
And good drainage.
You know, you really want to dig some sand or grit into the soil.
Yeah, that's what I usually do.
The grasses, blue fescue.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of Russian sage around here, too.
Is there? That is a great plant.
It is a great plant.
I actually have trouble growing it because I have really rich soil and not as much sun as it would like.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And you mentioned good old rattlesnake master, one of my favorite plants for names.
Oh,
anyway.
Do you like that? Do you grow that?
Yeah,
I
it grows here.
It.
Yeah. Yeah.
Eryngium yuccifolium.
Yep.
Yeah, just that name alone.
Yeah, it's a great name, rattlesnake master. And I've heard several reasons for the name. One that American Indians used it to treat rattlesnake bite,
mm-hmm.
and another that it was a sacred vision of having to do with rattlesnakes. And
uh-huh.
I don't know what the truth is, of course,
yeah.
but it's a terrific plant,
it
very
is a
terrific spiky.
Plant. Uh-huh.
Yuccifolia means has a leaf like a yucca.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a terrific prairie plant that will grow in clay soil with quite a bit of dampness.
This has been so delightful. We really appreciate your time.
Well, thank you for your interest. I hope that you enjoy growing lots of nice, shining silver plants.
I think that Bob and I will be including even more in our gardens.
I'm going back to my laboratory and start over again because
I'm doing too.
I was going through the back of your book, and I've got most of these. I just haven't put them together in the right places in the right way. So
that's the thing. There's always something to be done.
I've learned a ton myself today.
That's right.
Great. Well, I hope the book gave you some inspiration for finding them.
It did indeed, Karen. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Karen Busolini is a garden writer and photographer in South Kent, Connecticut, where she co-authored Elegant Silvers, Striking Plants for Every Garden. She also took the photographs. The book is published by Timber Press. And, of course, for more information, you can visit our website at wfpl.org.
Coming up next, we have listeners' questions and a new Latin word of the week. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy.
With some more questions.
We have some questions.
This is an old one and a new one at the same time. It's a conundrum.
It is a conundrum.
It's a perplexing one.
It is. It's from Gail Gilbert.
Yep.
Hi, Bob and Janine. I have a large 70-year-old maple in my backyard whose roots go all across the yard. Over the years, the roots have caused the sidewalk in my backyard and along the side of the house to slant. I'd like to redo the sidewalks, especially by the house, so rainwater doesn't flow towards the foundation. Her question is this, Bob, and it is, you know, a good question, but it's one of those tough situations.
Yeah.
Question is this. If I replace the sidewalks, the tree roots will undoubtedly be disturbed to some extent. Will this adversely affect the health of the tree? Are there measures to take to protect the tree?
Well, the short answer is yes, it will affect the health of the tree.
Yeah.
I think it will just depend on the extent of the sidewalks, but definitely, you know, when you disturb those roots near the surface, it'll make a difference in the tree over a period of time.
It will.
Measures to protect it depends just how careful you are. Maybe you can put the sidewalk back exactly the way it was, which won't help you any.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, slanted.
Right. It'll still be slanted, but you're almost going to have to put the sidewalk somewhere else or deal with the fact you're going to have some tree problems there eventually because they don't like their roots disturbed like that.
Yeah, they really don't. And that's the thing. It's like, can you reconfigure the sidewalk?
Yeah.
Can you make it something that's made out of more of an aggregate material that's loose that, you know, could potentially conform to, you know, you know what I mean? Not something that's hard and it's going to move, but something that can conform and stay flat despite the fact that the tree roots are there. You know, the roots that are in the top couple of inches of the soil are almost the most important roots for a tree. So we really do need to be mindful of what we do, you know. And that's why soil compaction is so bad and driving on underneath trees, parking underneath trees, all of that, you know, really does kind of do damage slowly. So you don't really see it until there's decline. And tree roots correspond directly, like one tree root underground will correspond directly to like a branch overhead. So what she could potentially find is if some of those were damaged or severed, she'd start to see sections of her tree, you know, die out because it wouldn't be able to take in nutrients, moisture, etc.
Well, if it does help, I have had big trees I've taken some roots off in limited areas and didn't hurt it too much, but you just have to be careful with that.
Yeah, it's serious.
You find somebody you trust.
Yep.
So let's get a more lighthearted question here. I'm depressed.
Depressing.
I know it. This is from Meredith Needham. Another Hoosier question for Miss Wishy. It's a two-part question. One of them's color-coded. Here's the first
one.
Again, for this show. Can you tell me why my seemingly full-grown Roma tomatoes are orange instead of red? And then she sent a picture along, and by golly, they were orange instead of red. I've been waiting and waiting for them to turn red, but they're not going to do it.
They're
starting to rot instead. It's a mystery. What can I do?
Well, you know, if it's if it looks like a rabbit, it is a rabbit. Did I just make something up?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? What's the saying? If it looks like a something, it is a something.
Yeah.
If it looks like a yellow or orange Roma, it is a yellow or orange.
Yeah, they
Roma.
Come in different colors, is what she doesn't understand.
Yeah, and you may have purchased a red Roma tomato, but mislabeling happens, you know, all kinds of things can go wrong in terms of plant production, from when it is a seedling to when it actually reaches a nursery to when it actually reaches your house, that it could have been mislabeled. So enjoy your yellow or orange Roma tomatoes.
By any other name, they taste the same, right?
Exactly. And it's funny because you know how I bought a whole bunch of heirloom tomatoes this spring to plant out, and I just sort of grabbed them randomly based on name. So I've had to be kind of, now that everything's coming ripe, from time to time, I got to get down and look at the tags to remind myself of which ones. Like, I bought this one that's called Evergreen Bob. It is not going to turn red. So I can't just kind of peruse and look for red ripening things because it stays green. So I got to, you know, make sure I know which tomatoes aren't going to turn
green.
Green, yeah. Or red, you know what I mean, and really stand out.
Do you have any square ones yet?
I do not have any square ones.
They were trying to make square tomatoes for better boxing.
But my mom got this one that actually kind of is squarish. It's called like a black Japanese tomato or something like that. Anyway, so yeah, you obviously have a orange Roma tomato, and say enjoy it.
Go with it, yeah.
That's right.
And continuing our color-coded theme here, one more question from Meredith Needham.
Mm-hmm.
I have one green zucchini plant and one yellow summer squash.
Mm-hmm.
I've had plenty of huge foliage and tons of blooms and not a single piece of fruit. I'm a frustrated first-time gardener. Help!
Okay, well, Meredith, first-time gardeners sometimes get consternated over their squash, don't you think, Bob? It is...
Or old gardeners, actually.
Well, but people need to be reminded. Yeah. Squash... The first blossoms that appear on squash typically are male blossoms. They do not produce fruit. The female blossoms produce fruit. The male blossoms open first, then the female blossoms open first, and then the bees fly around.
Ooh, a sex lesson.
And the
bees, I love this.
Of course. Yeah. The bees fly around, and then they pollinate, mm-hmm. and then you get your fruit. So two issues here. It's really hot out right now, so that can slow down some bee activity from when your blossoms are open. But your first blooms are going to be male. The female blooms, you will see an actual sort of ovary at the base of the bloom.
Oh, yeah.
And that will tell you that that's a female bloom, and that will tell you that that's the bloom that the fruit should actually come from. But you also need good pollination, so you need to make sure you've got a lot of good insects around, too.
And we can send pictures in plain envelopes for her if she's worried about.
That's right. So but don't worry. Sometimes you just have to be patient.
The graphic part of this
show.
Yeah,
exactly. Okay. The stuff we can't talk about over here.
Okay.
It's pretty basic.
Good. Well, if you have a black and white question for Janine or Bob, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org or email us at homegrown@WFPL.org or give us a phone call at 814-8246. Miss Wishy, I appreciate the fact you've gone to extra lengths this week to make me feel lousy.
You asked me specifically a couple of weeks ago.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
For a Latin word that meant sparse leaves or hair covering.
Hair covering.
And I actually found one for you.
You did.
So the Latin word of the week this week is epipsilis, epipsilum, or epipsila.
Epipsili, epipsila, epipsilum.
Somewhat bare.
Somewhat bare.
I.e. referring to sparse leaves or hair covering. All right. Wasn't this from like the Nancy Pelosi one? The Pelosis.
That's right.
Which was like hairy or whatever.
Yeah, see,
and this one
is unhairy.
Unhairy. Sparse leaves or hair covering. All right. So for example, I have two sweet examples.
Mm-hmm.
The third example, of course, would be you, Bob. Or your head,
I'll
at least.
I'll send a picture in.
Okay. For example, Viola epipsila, the marsh violet.
Yeah, the balding marsh violet.
I think it's just because they're sparse leaves, not sparse hair covering.
I wonder how you pronounce the next one.
Petiomelum,
uh-huh.
Don't you think? Petiomelum. Yep. Megalanthum, Petiomelum megalanthum,
uh-huh.
Variety epipsilum.
Right.
Indian breadroot.
Huh.
Basically, Indian breadroot, you use the root and it acts kind of like as a yeasty sort of thing.
Oh, more bread.
Yeah, so it's kind of cool.
Okay.
So, if you see epipsilum, or epipsila, it means somewhat bare, mostly referring to sparse leaves or its hair covering pop.
Go over and console it the best you can.
Okay.
Right.
Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, we head out to the fairgrounds for the Kentucky State Fair, where our agricultural heritage is alive and well.
Homegrown is produced by the Pure Gold Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. Our silver-lined website is maintained by Alice Thompson. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.